Good morning. It's Paul, and Pippin is in the back seat, and it is Wednesday, October, I think it's the 16th. I should probably just double check before I start recording. And it's about a quarter after 8 in the morning. The sun is coming up. I'm driving back from MBS Airport, which is conveniently located. I think it stands for Midland Bay City in Saginaw. It's conveniently located, or inconveniently located, exactly kind of at the midpoint between these three cities, which is sort of, it like makes it minimally inconvenient for everyone in the cities to get to. So I'm dropping off my stepmother, Cheryl Potts, the kid's grandma Cheryl. One of their only surviving grandparents. Step-grandparent, technically, but my father is the only grandparent still alive. We had a good visit. We have a stop. She came out to help with things for the birth of the new baby and visit with the kids. And I'm really glad I think we managed to get her out of this without getting her any viruses, infected with any viruses, although she may be, you know, incubating one to turn into a full-blown illness after she gets home or on the plane, even. Who knows? But that was my fear, is because she's not, you know, she's not young. She's 70, I think. And we didn't want to give her the flu. Several of us have been sick the last few weeks. And it's fall, you know, in Michigan is the season for influenza and norovirus, even more so than the hard winter, you know, the hard part of the winter, the cold part of the winter. But I think we got her through without making her sick, because, you know, we really don't want to kill the kid's grandma. So anyway, is that morbid? The flu kills people sometimes still, you know, or makes them very sick. I had a couple days of sickness, one full day of completely unable to work because of vomiting and diarrhea. That wasn't any fun. Best guess is, due to the exact symptoms, is that it was a norovirus, because we had a friend who brought her son over, and I think he gave it to Daniel. He didn't have any symptoms yet, but the next night I heard from his mom that he was throwing up and had actually gone to the hospital for throwing up so much. They were worried he had food poisoning or something. But, you know, it's just a virus. I'm passing a stopped garbage truck. I think I'm allowed to do that. Oh, it just says now, do not pass. Okay. But I got through in time. So we didn't want that. What can happen with a norovirus, especially in a house full of kids, or a daycare, or a, you know, retirement home, or something, is. That it can just blow through everyone. In very short order. We really didn't want that to happen. To navigate, not totally familiar with the route around, like the back way leaving the airport. One moment. Well, one thing is the sun today is a huge aid to navigation. So I'm reaching Tittabawassee and the sun's right in my face over my left shoulder, so I know that that's Tittabawassee going east. So that's helpful. So I don't have a... Yesterday I kind of had a topic in mind, which is I wanted to talk about taking Sam to the observatory. Less so today. I had something, but I should have written it down. I need to carry a little pack of index cards and make notes. But I'll just give kind of a status update, which is that... So we've planned little Benjamin Mary's baptism. It's coming up in a couple weeks. We know who his godparents are, our friends, the Solaks. Solak family. Pippin is in the back seat, kind of thrashing around. He gets fed up with being in the car seat. And so if you hear squeaking and chatter, that's why. Sam and Joshua have been going to school. I dropped them off this morning. Actually dropped them off early because I wanted to get Grandma Cheryl to the airport early. Unfortunately, the classroom was open at 1:45. It's not that far, but of course you always like, when there's a flight involved, you want to kind of front load it and give yourself extra time for the inevitable, traffic jam or something going wrong. But then if nothing goes wrong, then everyone's, you're like, oh, well, now I have nothing to do for 45 minutes. But it's probably better than the stress of the other way around. Some people always do it the other way. They make themselves late as possible just so they don't have to deal with the stress of waiting around, being bored. But I don't know. Somewhere in between would be nice. But she's there in plenty of time for her flight. And I'll be home in time for my morning conference call. I do this every morning for work. I dial into a web meeting and listen to a project manager in Indianapolis run through a spreadsheet of tasks and grill all the engineers about what's done and what's not done. Every morning. It takes about a half hour every morning. And it doesn't directly involve me very much. That's kind of frustrating because I'm like lower down on the tier of engineers working on the project. I'm completing test cases for code that these guys do. So when they finish something, my manager hands it off for me to do code inspections or write test cases. So, I mean, it is relevant to me what's being finished, but probably not daily because the progress isn't, you know, is slow, measured in days. And so most of the time it's just like, this one's a little closer to being finished, but yet, you know, there's no change in the status of what I'm working on. Anyway, that's not interesting. But sitting in my home office, talking to the computer, listening to the computer, mostly listening. I rarely talk except to say hi, good morning. And I have a mute button so that if I'm coughing or slurping my coffee or breakfast or whatnot, I can mute myself. I would have liked to stop and get a donut or like a breakfast sandwich or something, but I actually left my wallet on my desk at home. So I don't even have my driver's license. Oops. So I'm trying not to get pulled over. Would like to have, also, I don't think they're open, but if they were, I would stop quickly by the Barnes & Noble and pick up this review magazine that I wanted to get and didn't get last time, because I want to talk about it. I got some books in the mail. As I'm able to every month, I buy one or two books from my list, an ever-growing list. Usually it's more than one or two, usually it's more like five. The ever-growing list. Some of them are new books that I want to read. Some of them are books that I've read in the past and lost or given away or sold that I am trying to gradually replace. And some of them are books that I want, where I want to have a collectible copy. So the three that came yesterday, two of them were hardcover first editions of Greg Egan novels. And I have all his books, and I have most of them in hardcover first editions. And so I've been, as I'm able, I've been kind of rounding out the collection when I can find them for a price that I think is reasonable. $400 on a Libris is not reasonable. That's someone who is trying to claim the collector price, you know. $30? Maybe. So these cost more in the neighborhood of $30 or I think $40, which is more than the cover price. So there is kind of a collectible thing going on, but not 10 times more, you know. Anyway, I don't think Barnes & Noble is open, but I got a hardcover copy of the first edition, the British edition of Greg Egan's first big novel, not technically his first novel, but first big novel, Quarantine. And also which is the other one? Oh, Distress, which was maybe his fourth novel, something like that. Both of them are amazing novels. They're both science fiction. They're both fairly hard science fiction, although Quarantine gets a little crazy. Quarantine is about quantum physics and brain augmentation. And it's kind of a noir, like it's structured as a noir sort of thing. But it's just a fascinatingly weird book. It's not great in that the writing isn't stellar, but it's really competently done. I'm still impressed with it after quite a few years and having read it several times. And, well, basically what Quarantine does is it talks about ideas from quantum mechanics, but it does this by making them macroscopic. By, you know, what if this observer effect and this many worlds hypothesis could be manifested at a large scale in the physical world so that we could really observe it in our lives? What if that happened? What would that be like? And by doing that, it makes clear just how bizarre, how unintuitive, how crazily weird, but also poetic and beautiful and you know, striking these quantum principles, superposition and uncertainty and the observer effect, how weird these things really are. So the other one, Distress, is also a really fascinating book. It's about this quest for the theory of everything, but it's also about Australia and independence, the independence movement, the Aboriginal movement, the ideas of like citizens' rights, and this concept of like a founding like Sealand. I forget what he calls his island nation where these physicists are meeting, but it's a bioengineered island. It's a mechanism that bioengineered, built on these litho something. Forget the details. Tiny, they're like limestone, the plants that create limestone. But the whole island is floating, and there's a sequence in which the protagonist, who's a journalist, with a camera in his head, and this is an idea of Greg Egan's that goes back to his first novel called An Unusual Angle, is able to make a descent through a hole in the island, right down through the layers, down to the surf, down to the underside of the thing, and basically see how this biologically engineered landscape holds itself together. And it's just amazing. It's really, you know, it would be very cliched to say that a piece of writing is a tour de force, but this is just a really neat exposition of a plausible idea that we could bioengineer islands like this in the ocean and create nations with their own, you know, that have never existed before. And it's not that far-fetched, given what is happening with these manufactured islands off, is it Dubai, I think? There's a archipelago called The World, where basically these little sand islands are being manufactured in the shapes of different countries of the world and sold. But this thing is a pipe dream. It's dissolving. It's collapsing. It was never sustainable. It was never rational. It was just an economic frenzy. But it's also, so the book is also about this quest for the theory of everything, physicists getting together to study and try and promote their finishing touches on their drafts of a physical TOE, theory of everything, that basically a document which uses the absolute minimal possible number of equations to connect all the scales and forces that explain modern physics, and some speculation about what would happen to the world if this really existed. And it also with some ideas from quantum observation, which is that the human observation and human recognition of the TOE is part of the process, is part of bringing it into existence, and that this has side effects. And one of the side effects is that as the scientists get closer and closer to like nailing down physical law and in a sense freezing it in that observed form, people start to experience this distress, this illness, this nervous illness, like where their own nervous systems are affected by sort of this proximity, this getting closer and closer to nailing down the fundamental nature of reality, which might, at the, to use the quantum concept, is still in flux. But once it's nailed down, then basically the doors are open to completing our science, which includes space travel with a TOE drive. Oh, it looks like Pippin has realized that we're coming back home and not going back to see Grandma Cheryl at the airport or something. And he has a sad. So, I do too. It's been great to have her here. I'm going to pause for a moment. Okay. I'm actually back, and I have dropped Pippin off at home to hang out with his mom and get a little comforting over his disappointment at not being able to go to school or go with his grandma. I'm not sure what he thought he was doing. He can't necessarily explain things to a 2.5-year-old. But I have just a few minutes left because I got done so early dropping off Grandma Cheryl. So rather than do something sensible, like fix myself breakfast and go sit at my computer, I'm going to take another, I have 12 or 13 minutes to finish talking about Greg Egan, which I didn't plan this for topic, but I've been wanting to talk about different writers and get a little walking in to stretch my legs, because it's about the only exercise I get aside from carrying babies. So I'm in the neighborhood. Beautiful fall day. Still too clammy for my taste. It rained last night. Wet leaves. That about sums it up. So, anyway, Distress is a really interesting book. If you like hard science fiction at all, I would really recommend Quarantine and Distress, and also Permutation City, which is about the subject of uploading human consciousness to a simulated environment. And it gets weird. It gets very weird and very thought-provoking. It's like, it's one of the books that you'll still be musing on and thinking about 10 years after you read it. 20 years after you read it, maybe. I think it has, but might be 20 years now. Anyway, Greg Egan has a lot of books. His most recent stuff, this orthogonal series, and some of his other stuff, is it's hardcore in that his story is, it's a cool story, but it's very much in the service of speculative physics. And I mean, like, it's an alternate universe novel, as in not just here's what most science fiction is, you know, here's what our universe could become, here's what our world could become based on what we know about physical laws stretched just 10% or altered just a little bit. Like, you admit the possibility that physical travel faster than light is possible. So, and then you have, you know, a setting for a story, a novel, whatever. Well, in these new books, in the orthogonal series, he's creating an alternate universe like some writers do in alternate history. It's an alternate physics where some of the physical constants are slightly altered. And so it has this real sense of strangeness to it. It's not quite our world. And it's, in a way, it's more ambitious than a lot of classic science fiction by people like Hal Clemens, who wrote Mission of Gravity, and Robert Forward, who wrote Dragon's Egg. It's more ambitious than what they were doing. Dragon's Egg is an amazing book. I would highly recommend that if you like hard science fiction. It's probably a little, the science is probably dated, but that's just a hazard of how science works. But it's an amazing story. Probably the politics of the crew, the sexual politics and the gender and race, they're probably now would read as dated and stereotyped, but, you know, it's hard to care much about that. That's not really what the book is about, so, you know, things go out of date. But Dragon's Egg, fascinating. And I think of Egan as basically the successor to that hard science fiction mantle, you know, except that, like I said, he goes one up in that he creates a new physics. And he has Java applets on his website that will animate and teach you this stuff and formulas in his books. I'm not saying this is easy going, and it's definitely not for everyone, but you know what, you can actually read the story and get an appreciation for the strangeness of the physics and how they're different intuitively rather than mathematically. So you don't really have to understand all the math, and I don't understand all the math. I can work through bits of it, but you don't have to understand all of it to kind of get an intuitive grasp of the world he's creating. Not for everyone, he gets pretty abstract. So it's not that when he does work on characters, they're good characters. But some of his worlds are pretty abstract, like in Diaspora. It's another book of his that I really recommend. Most of the characters basically live in simulation, and living physically on the surface of the earth is kind of old school, retro, you know, exposing yourself to mortality. That's a big theme in his work, in a lot of his short stories. There's a short story called Border Guards. Some of them get even more abstract. Child's Ladder basically takes place mostly following a catastrophe where the universe is collapsing. And the happy-go-lucky days that follow. And it's also very abstract. Most of it's in simulation, and most of the characters, the people doing the actions are uploaded or created, were never human. They weren't made with sperm and egg in the traditional way. They were modeled. And exist only in simulation, which you really cease to think of it as somehow fake or inauthentic. It just becomes different. It's like being of a different race. Oh, you know, I'm black, she's white. He exists only as a computer simulation. Anyway, Egan has also written a ton of short stories. They comprise five books or so. There's some overlap between the collections, but the collection called Oceanic would be a really good place to start with him. And an earlier collection called Axiomatic. His stories are amazing. So, this leads you, maybe you really get into this writer and you'd like to say, I wonder if I could get a signed copy. As far as I can tell, Egan doesn't get out much. He seems to have a policy of not signing books. I think I've seen one up for sale, and that may have been from very early in his career, before he decided that he just wasn't going to sign books. And I don't think he appears at cons or any events, and this is kind of remarkable, but there seem to be no photographs of him online anywhere. So I don't like to think of myself as being kind of celebrity obsessed or whatnot, but after reading so much of this guy's work and feeling like I've been, you know, seeing the what goes on in his head, I do become curious, like, what does he look like? And he has, like, created a little deliberate policy, I think, that he enforces, and of basically keeping all images of himself offline. It's not entirely clear to me why. I get that he doesn't want to be a celebrity or feed into the cult of celebrity somehow, and probably doesn't want to participate in the collectible book, you know, collectible signatures. You know, will you sign these 10 copies so I can charge more for them, kind of thing. I get that. But I am curious. I think he gives the game away a little bit when he has his main character in distress. It's hinted that he is autistic, but in the book he doesn't want to discuss or have recognized the fact that he's autistic. He doesn't want to submit himself to a brain scan. So Egan may be a high-functioning person with autism. And so part of the part of this distaste for socialization, socializing, may be just that. But it really, if true, you have to wonder, what does that definition even mean, if someone is that gifted? And it's not just, his stuff is not all, he does write about emotional human relationships in a fascinating way many times. One of his more recent novels, Zendegi, is about a father who's dying and seeking a way to create a simulation of himself that he can pass off as a legacy, that he can leave as a legacy to his son. So the son would be able to basically speak to the parent after he's gone, would be able to ask him questions and whatnot. And it's a very emotional book. It's a very passionate project, and it's about kind of politics in the multicultural world, the clash between Islamic values and modern democratic non-theistic states. And so very relevant, interesting novel. So he's not a robot, I'm pretty sure. Anyway, I don't want to pry into Greg Egan's personal life at all, but it would be interesting just to satisfy my curiosity and see what he looks like. And I'd like to shake his hand and say thank you for inspiring me so much and writing such amazing books. So maybe I can do that here. But yeah, he's a writer who you will almost never see, almost never saw in a Borders, will almost never see in a Barnes & Noble. He's just off the shelf. You might see one copy of Quarantine. And this is just tragic. He should be, all his books should be in print, in paperback, being reprinted, and they should have a whole shelf in Barnes & Noble, the way that, you know, whatever flavor of the week urban vampire story, urban vampire writer, urban fantasy writer, supernatural romance writer has a whole shelf, but he doesn't. Anyway, life's not fair. I'm going to go inside, go up and boot up my computer and sign into my virtual world. Talk to you all later. Bye.